I'm Ben Johnson, and this is Marketplace Tech. This week, Matthew Keyes was sentenced to 2 years in prison. Keyes has worked as a social media editor and journalist. Last year, he was convicted of giving away login credentials to the hacking group Anonymous back in 2010 and encouraging the group to deface the website of the LA Times. Keyes says he's still innocent and also that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which the government used to convict him, is fundamentally flawed. He was willing to talk to us about the case. Matthew, thanks for speaking with us.
Hi, good to be here.
What do you want people to learn from your case?
Well, what I've said all along is that I didn't do the conduct that was alleged. There was an indictment 3 years ago that charged me with essentially password trafficking, although that's actually a separate part of the law that they didn't charge. But that's the conduct that was alleged. And they claimed that the government claimed that I had access to a former employer's system that I couldn't have had access to because I hadn't worked there in 2 months. And that this access gave a group of hackers the ability to change a Los Angeles Times news article for 40 minutes, which is completely baseless. I mean, there would have been no way for me to have had access to the internals of the company's computer system, let alone the Los Angeles Times, which is a property that I've never worked for and never had access to. There was a lot about this case that just didn't add up. We took it to trial because there were a few plea agreements offered in the case, and all of them had conduct in there that I would have had to acknowledge as true that I knew to be untrue. There was really no opportunity to clear my name without having to go to trial. We went to trial. There was a complex case that was put on that was very dense, very technologically involved to the point where we were discussing computer systems and logs and information that was way over my head. And I think that because this case was so complex, the jury found as they found. And we had to, you know, continue the process from there. There was a sentence yesterday, which was completely unavoidable, given the jury's finding. And yesterday was the beginning of starting the appellate process that can hopefully overturn this completely baseless conviction, help me clear my name, and in the process may also lead us to narrowly tailoring the applicability of this draconian computer crimes law so that at least in this district and in this circuit, the Ninth Circuit, which governs a good chunk of the West Coast, including Silicon Valley, this type of prosecution can't be brought against another person again.
Now, you've spoken publicly against the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, I think, many times now, and that's what you were convicted of violating. In your view, what would be a better law?
There's absolutely no doubt that we need some kind of law or law structure that governs positive computer use. There absolutely needs to be a law that provides for both civil and criminal remedies to people who use computers in a malicious way. Having said that, I think we need to look at what the term malicious means. When people think of computer hacking, they think of something on a huge magnitude. They think of somebody accessing credit card information, personal information, stealing identities, stealing trade secrets, serious government secrets, and perhaps trafficking them or using them for their own personal gain otherwise. That absolutely should be a crime. I don't think there's any dispute about that. However, this particular federal statute covers a lot of behavior that people would find to be rather benign on the internet. And a good example of that that I always like to give is sharing a Netflix or HBO Go username and password, something that celebrities have even done and have spoken openly about. That is a federal offense under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And what's even worse is that offenses under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act are considered under the legal definition of a federal terrorism crime.
Sure.
If you look at the definition of that crime, the CFAA violations broadly fall under that, And it just seems absurd that somebody who passes a Netflix username or password could be targeted by the federal government in Homeland Security investigations, which is exactly what they used in this case. We have documentation that shows that they followed national security procedures in investigating me.
Yeah, but Matthew, I mean, people have used login credentials to do real damage at a massive scale, right? And you provided, according to the conviction, those kinds of credentials to hackers. I know you maintain your innocence here, but shouldn't there be real consequences to that kind of crime, even something as simple as sharing credentials?
I think I would defer that opinion to people who understand the complexities of computer law a little bit better. And one of those groups happens to be the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They've written to some extent about this case and about how punishments over computer misuse should absolutely fit the crime. The outcry from yesterday in the public sphere seems to largely be that this punishment, the 2-year prison, 2-year probation punishment, doesn't fit the allegations. And that's a real concern for people who use computers in a very expert way, and should be a real concern for people who use computers in an everyday fashion.
Right. But I mean, you're a journalist. You take journalism, you take the news very seriously. And we're talking about a case in which people changed a news item. And I can see that being incredibly dangerous.
Oh, I can too. I would definitely agree with you. The integrity of the news as a journalist is of paramount concern to me, and not just in computer intrusion cases, but also just in how the internet can spread false news. Not that I think that should warrant a crime. That's absolutely a free speech issue. But the integrity of the news is absolutely important to me. It's one of the reasons why for 10 years, I've tried to cover the news as best I could with as much integrity and honesty as I possibly can. However, it's worth noting that the government, prosecutors and law enforcement appear to know who the person who changed the article was. There have been stories written on this, and certainly we've seen documentation on this, and they never charged that person. So when you consider that, and you consider the government's argument that they needed to make a prosecution to protect the integrity of the news, yet they never went after the person who actually did it, supposedly, one has to question what the motive of the government was here. And I think, you know, I've often talked about this. I think it's clear to me that when I didn't cooperate with a government investigation after I had researched and done stories on Anonymous, that they looked at me as a criminal suspect. They executed a search warrant on those grounds to try to get source material that I felt I was under no obligation to hand over. When they accessed that source material and saw that they couldn't identify any of the Anonymous members that I had observed, I think they had to find some reason for using those time and resources. And the result was which, about a year later, I wound up in court as a criminal defendant.
What would you say to the average person who looks at this case and says, okay, fine, he maintains his innocence, but here's a guy, he's been convicted, he's alleged to have, or he's been convicted of, you know, giving away credentials to a news site and working with hackers. I think the average person would look at that case and say, yeah, send him to jail.
I disagree. And I think that if you look at the reaction of the public to the story yesterday.
Well, I mean, I see a reaction in the media, right? I see a supportive reaction to you in the media. But I'm talking about the average Joe. Does the average Joe, do they really, you know, look at your case, you think, still, and say, give the guy a break? Because my assumption would be they look at your case and they say, psh, send this guy to jail.
I think that's a false assumption. I think if you look at the, well, let me clarify. I know that if you look at the reaction from people who understand how computers work on a very cursory level, they're appalled by this prosecution and this subsequent punishment. I have seen people who have said, you know, he should have gotten more time. I've also seen people who suggested that I off myself like Aaron Swartz. And so I think you have to understand the context of people who tend to give opinions on the internet. But I, in looking at the at general opinions online, they seem to be heavily appalled by the appearance of somebody transmitting a username and a password. Again, I bring up the example of Netflix or HBO Go,
sure,
as warranting 2 years in prison and 2 years probation. And let's not forget that if you were in court yesterday, which I understand not everybody could be, but the judge spoke very highly of my work ethic, of my, you know, of being a almost a model citizen over the last 6 years, not having committed any crime, not posing a danger to the community. I don't have computer monitoring or travel on my restriction. I can live a free life from now until at least June. And the importance of the sentence that was handed down, according to the judge, was to send a message to other people. Well, people are receiving that message and they're appalled by it. It's another example of why these computer laws that govern all of our online activity are bad and are in serious need of reform. So they bring offenses and subsequent punishments to the level of what people consider to be routine online activity or minor offenses when it comes to computers. There's no reason why somebody facing the same type of allegations that I faced should be threatened with a quarter century in prison, $750,000 in fines, and 9 years of supervised release. And that's what I was initially facing.
You've been criticized by the government in terms of how freely you've spoken to the media, which of course you're doing right now. Do you feel like in the grand scheme of things, now that you've been convicted and sentenced, do you think that was the right move to be as outspoken as you have?
I think I probably should have spoken up more. I look back on it and my whole focus over the last 3 years, you know, I couldn't speak about the case prior to it going to trial. And there's still a lot of things I can't speak about the case now because of the potential of, I mean, we're going to appeal the case and there's always the possibility that it could wind up in a retrial and then we have to go through this whole process again, which I'm hoping doesn't happen because it's been a very exhausting process. But over the last 3 years, I've been very focused on telling stories of significant importance, finding stories that are underreported and bringing them to public discourse. And I think I've been somewhat successful in doing that. But that's taken a front seat to me talking publicly about this case, trying to, you know, explaining to the public why this was a bad prosecution. And you know, asserting my innocence and you know, rallying around reform for this law that has impacted me greatly and really impacts everybody to some degree. And so I wish I had said more. However, there's been quite a bit of attention after the verdict came down, quite a bit of attention after the sentence came down, and I'm definitely going to be a lot more noisier from now until I can, which as of right now is June, but hopefully will be much longer.
How are you doing personally?
I'm exhausted. This has been a very exhausting process. When you have the weight of the federal government, which represents all 300 million people in the country against you, and you feel like the odds and resources are stacked against you, and it's a constant battle to assert your innocence and to try to explain to people why this prosecution is so bad. I mean, it's gotten a little bit easier because I think people have started to realize it now. It's becoming more apparent why this was such a bad prosecution and why it was so heavy-handed and such an abuse of discretion by the government. But in totality, it's absolutely exhausting. And there are days when I feel very fired up and very motivated by the support, but there are many, many more days, when I'm just tired. And thankfully I have the support of a large number of the public behind me, and some great attorneys and great friends and great family who have rallied behind me. And I think without them, it would have been incredibly challenging. There's been some pretty dark days over the last 3 years, which I'm not going to talk about on the radio. But it's been very challenging and it's been very exhausting. And that's why this going to appeals, appealing this case is so important to me, because I don't want somebody else to have to go through what I went through. Ideally, that would mean reforming the law on a national level, and that would require congressional action. And I just don't see that happening. They seem to be wanting to tighten these laws more than bringing them in line with today's computer activity. But we have a real shot at doing that in the Ninth Circuit with this case, narrowing the applicability. So at least in this type of case, prosecutors could use a little bit more discretion in whether they go after people for what I think the greater public sees is pretty benign activity. And that's important because so much of our technology that we take for granted comes from this area. And these laws govern that kind of behavior. So it's very important to me that we continue this fight, despite as exhausted as I might be. I think the greater fight is worth fighting. And we're gonna charge on.
Matthew Keyes, thank you very much for talking.
Thank you.